Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
The fundamentals of a democratic society are being closed out. The elections now, they're wealth elections. They are elections that allow unlimited money to nullify the votes. And if they can't nullify the votes by sheer money in terms of the candidates who they espouse, they will do it by voter suppression.
Hello, welcome to Mr. Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. My guest today is Ralph Nader, who, of course, you know, of course, you've heard of. I'm fascinated by Nader. He has had, I think, one of the most interesting lives and one of the most important lives of any American around today. I think people of my generation, including me, mostly know him for the 2000 and 2004 presidential runs. But before that, he created, like, willed into being this remarkable consumer movement that has affected almost everything in our lives, what is in the cars we drive, how the food we eat is checked. I mean, it's one of the most remarkable examples of policy entrepreneurship that there is in existence. He was named one of the most 100 influential Americans by Life and by The Atlantic and by Time. So I've wanted to talk to him for a while just to understand how he thinks. I mean, he's still out there doing interesting work. He's got a podcast. He's got a new book out called How the Rats Reformed Congress. You know, he's tireless, just a tireless human being. One thing that I want to note, because people might wonder where it is, we talk about third-party candidacies in here. I made a decision here. It's a decision I've made in other podcasts like this one to not talk about the thing that I did not believe I could add any light on. Ralph Nader has been asked many times about the 2000 election. He has a very standard spiel he gives on that. I read it when I was preparing for this, and I did not want to just repeat that. I was not going to change his mind. He was not going to change your mind. So we talk about third-party candidacies and I guess a little bit about his in a high altitude way. I wanted a podcast that was more about the way he thinks and about other moments in his career than a podcast that walked back along ground that I think has been pretty well trod. And so much so that I don't see a lot of light left in it. But we do talk about Howard Schultz's potential candidacy. We do talk about, you know, how voters make decisions between these sides. So we get at it a bit. Anyway, I think it's a pretty interesting conversation. It's fascinating to hear the way he thinks about things. And I hope you enjoy it as well. As always, my email is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here's Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Let me begin here. What does it mean to you to be a citizen? What is the role of a citizen?
Well, the role, obviously, is that you're able to vote. I mean, that's the primal obligation in a democracy, although it's minimal engagement. Being a citizen is something that requires an adjective, which is public. Public citizen means you don't just take care of your private life, your family, your kids, but you go into the public arena. You go to town meetings. You go to marches, demonstrations. You go to courtrooms. You go to neighborhood gatherings to deal with issues of the community, issues that, as Thomas Jefferson said, of self-governance, things that you can't solve for yourself, and you got to solve together with other people. So it means working at different hierarchies. You got to work at the local, state, national, international level. And there are enough people around, so their particular inclinations, temperaments, and choices will provide more than is necessary, more than the 1% that is ever necessary, reflecting public opinion, to turn public policy around, no matter how powerful the corporations are or the opponents. 1% of the people organized in the congressional districts, for example, representing public opinion, could get Medicare for all, could get living wage for all, could get all the things through Congress because, you know, after all, there are only 535 of them and we're millions back home. and we know their names. So it's really astonishing to me that people don't know that the phrase of action in a civic democracy is, it's the Congress, people. It's the state legislature. Those are the smallest but most powerful branches of government under our constitutions.
In your most recent book, I think it's now your penultimate most recent book, you're a rapid book writer. As somebody who's been working on a book for years, I quite admire it. But in one of your recent books, you have a Eugene Debs quote about, he's asked, what has most disappointed you in your time in public life? And he says that the American people could have anything they want if only they would organize to get it. Do you think the absence of the kind of organization you're talking about and that Debs at that point was lamenting, do you think that is something?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, a democracy is nothing without civic organization. And, you know, we can exercise individually our free speech. But if we don't lock arms together, we cannot confront the ultimate locked arm organization called the global corporation. Because the government is organized, the corporations are organized, and they know why. If we don't organize, they can individuate us. And that's what the consumer merchandising strategy is to individuate our choices, never to talk about cooperative buying as consumers, never to talk about consumer co-ops. It's always individual choices, however ridiculous the choices may be between Pepsi and Coca-Cola, for example, or MasterCard and Visa. The big problem today is lack of civic motivation. And why? Because people think of themselves as individuals, and then they say, well, who am I? I don't have any power. I don't count. I better just pay attention to my private life and try to get by. And that's where the challenge is. The challenge for civic organizers is to show what happens and what has happened in American history in the pursuit of justice when people band together. They band together as workers and unions. So the organized opposition tries to get anti-union laws in and tries to get anti-union law firms in to bust up efforts. And we want to band together as consumers. And guess what? It's very hard to develop communication consumer to consumer, to band together. And the co-op laws are often not that facilitative. There's virtually no way to band together as small taxpayers against corporate tax escapes, loopholes, tax havens abroad, and their immunities under the tax system. So the issue is civic motivation arises when people think that if they spend their time together, it's going to make a difference.
Is there any country or territory that, let's say, is over 30 million people that has the kind of ongoing civic motivation that you're discussing here?
Switzerland is probably the first choice here in terms of answering your question. They're organized into cantons. They have a vibrant consumer cooperative economy. In fact, last I checked, two of the largest food co-ops represented almost 50% of food sales. And one of them has a newspaper and affords adult education, sells auto insurance, not just food. They also rotate their elected officials so that the status of a elected official, we would call them politicians, is higher in Switzerland than almost any other country in the world because they rotate. A lot of them come in and out. The Scandinavian countries have a tradition of cooperatives and strong labor unions, so they are more advanced.
When you look at the Scandinavian countries, do you think that their particular kinds of successes reflect institutions or cultures and compositions? An objection I often hear people give when I say, oh, you know, look at what they're doing in Scandinavia with flexicurity or whatever it might be is, look, these are small countries. They have very little, on average, diversity, and they have very distinct cultural backgrounds, and that might work in very particular places. I mean, some people point in America to Utah and say, hey, look, that kind of looks like that, a somewhat different political consensus, but very high levels of civic motivation and engagement. But that when you're dealing with a place as broad and big and strange and diverse and disparate as America, you can't get that because it's not something you can will into being through policy. It speaks to something that is deeper in a country's history and its makeup.
Well, let's look at it historically, Ezra. In the United States, the strongest co-ops were started by immigrants and the solidarity of immigrants, like the Finns in the upper Midwest and their co-ops. So on that point, you're right. On the other hand, about 115 years ago, Norway was terribly poor, unbelievably impoverished. And of course, they had a homogeneous country. So they didn't do it through homogeneity. They did it through democracy. They did it through initiatives that we call now social democratic politics. And now they're the most prosperous. And, you know, they have a social safety net that's so comprehensive that the problem in Norway is boredom rather than insecurity, anxiety, dread, and fear. The other point that's important is that a lot of our early banks in the Industrial Revolution were started by immigrants, like the Immigrants Bank of New York. So that was solidarity there. The most powerful producer and consumer cooperative, a multi-billion dollar operation in the world, is in the Basque country in Spain, as you know, Mondragon. That has a solidary ethnicity to it. So you can't really come out one way or another. There are examples where it's institutional reform, political reform, economic reform across the board. And there are examples when you have the primordial solidarities of ethnicity that get these institutions underway. Credit unions, which now have some 70, 80 million members in our country, came from Quebec, the French Canadians. They brought it down to New Hampshire over 100 years ago. Would it have happened without that kind of solidarity? Probably it wouldn't have happened as soon.
So one of the things that I'm interested in your thought is, one reason I wanted to begin the conversation around citizenship is it is important to the way you see the world, as I understand it, to get over this chasm between passive citizenship and active citizenship, between citizen and public citizen. And what's really interesting to me in your work is that you have a similar dynamic around capitalism. If public citizen plays that role in your idea of government, it seems to me that an engaged consumer plays that role in your idea of how capitalism should work. Can you talk a bit about what you think the role of the consumer should be if consumers were motivated?
Well, first you start with what's the grounding basis of any democratic society. It's civic activity. It starts with two conversations between citizens and then grows, and then more and more people talk about it. It starts moving into the electoral and political arenas, and it starts moving through the media. And that's one reason, I think, why the civic community has been shut out. That is, one of the indices of a deteriorating democratic society is when they close out from the mass media the civic community. And we've had experience with that. In 2016, we had the greatest congregation of civic thinkers and doers brought together on more issues and redirections in American history at Constitution Hall. 162 presenters, people who really changed America, people who are thinking hard about the distribution of power and justice in our country. And they were completely blacked out, even by public radio and by PBS. It got virtually no coverage. And it was all about Trump in those days. So when it comes to capitalism, you have to have adjectives again. Small business capitalism is a part of a vibrant democracy. I mean, I grew up, my father was a restaurateur. He had a bakery and a delicatessen. He was a capitalist. But corporate capitalism, giant corporate capitalism, is antithetical to democracy. It is inherently concentrated hierarchical power, inherently secretive, inherently transnational, in the sense that it has no allegiance to community or country other than to exploit them and abandon them at will wherever it can find better profits and cheaper labor and more permissive governments. So we do have to make that distinction. I don't think young people today are making those distinctions, because if you just say capitalism, for heaven's sake, I mean, every society known to human beings has markets. And if you have markets, unless they're all government owned, you're going to have capitalism. So the issue is concentration of power. That's why I don't like isms, because you say, well, it's communism, socialism, anarchism, capitalism. The issue is how do these systems deal with deconcentrated and accountable power? Because if they don't, they're all going to produce bad results.
So let me push you on this a little bit, because I think this is interesting. A lot of people would say, well, democracy is what people choose. Whatever the people in a democracy are choosing, like, that is a democracy as long as they're freely able to choose it. And so to say that large corporations are antithetical to democracy in a country where a lot of people, like large corporations, choose to support them both with dollars and obviously by not voting in politicians who will break them up, destroy them, put caps on concentration and so on. What does it mean to say they're antithetical to democracy in that context?
Well, in a sense, they can't tolerate clean elections. They love a two-party duopoly they can manipulate. They don't like third parties. They don't like access to justice in the courts. Look how they're trying to restrict the law of torts, one of our great private freedoms inherited from England, where you don't have to ask permission if you're wrongfully injured. You go to a contingent fee lawyer, and you're supposed to be guaranteed a right of trial by jury. Well, they've been blocking that more and more and more in the last 40, 50 years under this outrageous phrase, tort reform, instead of calling it tort deform. Then the other pillar of freedom is freedom of contract. Conservatives are supposed to love that. And 99% of our contracts are fine print contracts written by the vendor for the vendor's privilege and power. In other words, we are contract peons. Contract servitude is the reign, coin of the reign in the American economy. So you have two of the major pillars, the two pillars of private law that's supposed to spell the fundamentals of a democratic society are being closed out. The elections now, they're wealth elections. They are elections that allow unlimited money to nullify the votes. And if they can't nullify the votes by sheer money in terms of the candidates who they espouse, they will do it by voter suppression. They have their proxies. The politicians are their proxies. And so they do gerrymandering where the politicians pick their voters. Imagine that, instead of the voters picking the politicians. And they block ballot access. I've had a lot of experience in noticing that in a state like Texas, it's more difficult to get on the ballot than in 10 European countries combined or in Canada. And when you block candidates from getting on the ballot, you're blocking meaningful choice by voters. So it affects the value of the vote as well as the right of a candidate to give voices and choices broader than the two parties dialing for the same commercial dollars. And then it's the military and foreign policy, where these giant corporations profiteer and have a vested interest in war. They have a vested interest in distorted public budgets, where our public works and infrastructure are crumbling for lack of resources to repair, while the money goes to the American empire, blowing up infrastructure and socioeciding countries like Iraq and Libya. Yes, and one can go just on. But notice that these corporations have even stripped their owners of any kind of voice and power. So they're even against one of the pillars of capitalist theory, which is if you own property, you're supposed to have reasonable control over its deployment. Well, they've turned it completely upside down, and the managerial corporate bosses now run the company, and they can do almost anything they want, including Apple buying back $100 billion worth of stock without even asking their owners for permission. Just Tim Cook and one guy presents it. It improves the metrics for their executive compensation, and they get a rubber stamp board of directors to say, okay.
Let me ask you something about the way you sort of frame this. All these corporations, not to sound too much like Mitt Romney, which is not something I'm usually accused of, are made up at some level of people. Do you think that in the way you see it, that being at the high level of big multinational corporations changes people? Or that the corporations sort of have their own incentives and the people sort of end up being part of them? I mean, when I talk to a lot of folks in these worlds, and I've had to do a fair amount of business reporting in my time, yeah, it's like they don't tend to like gerrymandering. They tend to be pretty narrowly concerned with their own incentives. I don't think that many of them would say, I'm out here trying to start wars so I can make more missiles. I take the point that in many cases they end up supporting those things or other things that one might find objectionable. But do you find that to be a fact of the psychology of humans inside corporations, or do you find that to be a fact of corporate organizations that end up acting as if they are organisms unto themselves, and the human beings end up just sort of as cogs in the inorganic machine there?
Well, you've put it properly. They live two lives. Some of them teach Sunday school. They're kind to their family. They're fairly good neighbors down the street. But once they get into a corporate structure, they're corporatized, which means that the unilateral maniacal obsession of judging all the moves of a corporation by sales, profits, and executive bonuses shape them and control them. And they have to be held responsible because they're not totally powerless in a corporate structure. They can turn it around. That's why if you turn the CEO around on an issue in a big corporation, you can turn the corporation around. When Arch Bow, the CEO of Allstate, decided to promote airbags and irritated the heck out of GM, Ford, and Chrysler in the 70s, he turned around the whole company. He got on TV with me on the, you know, Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin show. So on the one hand, they are shaped by the corporation. On the other, because power is so concentrated in corporations at the top, they don't have any excuses. They can change it. But it's easy to go with the flow, and that's how they make huge amounts of money. And that's where the temperament, that's where the inclination of people who don't have much courage or sense of posterity or sense of justice end up.
Let me ask you one more question on this topic. In my more pessimistic moments, one of the things that I think is, if a system requires large amounts of large numbers or large fractions of the population, or even not that large, just a lot of people, to be constantly deeply engaged, doing the work of a public citizen, of an active consumer, this system is often going to fail. Most people don't enjoy doing that kind of work. They're busy, they're tired, that we almost need a system that is somehow better at operating a little bit on its own than asking that much. And I recognize that that is a theory in which you're throwing out a lot of what makes democracy beautiful. And you've had such a long career in this space, and I think I've seen the difficulty of getting people to consistently and over long periods of time demonstrate the kind of engagement that you have. And, you know, and I think some of that is characterological, right? You clearly like being engaged. I like being engaged, but a lot of people don't. I'm curious where you come down on that. I'm curious if you think there's just a flaw in the systems or just a nut we haven't cracked.
Well, let's parse what you're saying, because
that would probably be good, yes.
It invites a lot of nuance. It invites a lot of nuance. Number one, as I've said in many books, but most prominently in a little paperback I put out a few years ago called Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, American advances in justice have overwhelmingly been started and finished by very few people. Even the civil rights movement never had more than 1% of the people spending a few hundred hours a year linked with one another pushing for civil rights in the 60s, for example. It never takes more than 1%. If you have majority opinion behind you, or you can build majority opinion by disclosing how unsafe cars were, for example, in the 60s, it never takes more than 1%. Well, how much is that in congressional districts? That's 2.5 million people. Well, let's be even more realistic. I don't think it takes more than 0.25%. So let's say that's 700,000 people distributed in 435 congressional districts, committed to an interlocking move on Congress, summoning senators and representatives to their own town meetings and agendas, spending $300 to $500 a year. That's about what a hobby goes for, you know, for stamps and coins, and they spend somewhat more for bird watching, and opening up an office or two with two or three people in every congressional district full time. Now, is that much of an exertion? If you add it all up, Ezra, it doesn't come close in total person hours to what people spend either watching birds or playing serious bridge tournaments. So let's get it down to scale and not exaggerate it, because if we allow ourselves to exaggerate what is needed, you can't get there. You can't expect 50% of the people, 20% of the people, to drop what they're doing. Single moms, you know, daycare, two jobs, low pay, commute. But if you break it down, how many people did it really take to put the environmental issue on the map in 1970? How many people did it take to alert Reagan that Republicans and Democrats wanted him to sit down and negotiate with the Soviets on arms control? It's shockingly small, but they're reflecting public opinion. It's just what Abraham Lincoln said. With public sentiment, you can do almost anything. Without it, it's very, very difficult. Now, go back to our elementary school. Elementary school has one of its purposes, inadvertent or otherwise, is to raise students into believing how powerless they are. They're not taught any kind of civic engagement with the community, with few exceptions. They're not taught civic skills. I mean, they can be taught free of information laws and how to use them at the state or federal level in middle school. In fact, they can be taught tax law, contract law, tort law, the rudiments of it, in high school. I know a corporate tax lawyer who's teaching tax law in high school. And I said, John, I mean, isn't this a little heavy? He says, no, not at all. They get it. They don't have to go into it as deep as law schools do. But we're raising 12 classes of children, as we speak, from K to 12, into studied powerlessness. And they're told in all kinds of ways, forget it. Believe, don't think. Forget it. Learn how to manipulate a computer screen and write code. Learn how to be lucrative cogs in some big corporate wheel. Don't learn how to be effective citizens. In fact, a lot of high school kids can't even tell you the three branches of government, surveys have shown. I was speaking at Hotchkiss, you know, upscale school in Connecticut, a couple of years ago, and we went to lunch, and the students who were most politically interested came to lunch. It was about 10 kids. And I said to them, who's the governor of Connecticut? They didn't even know. I said, well, how about the two senators? They didn't even know.
But let me push you on this, because this is what I think is, this is where my, when I'm having a bad day, when I'm feeling pessimistic, this is where it comes from. There's a way of framing what you're saying, and it's the way you frame it in that book, which I actually really do recommend. I think it's a wonderful book, which is, it would take on some level so little. We could change so much with so little. But that's always been true. That's why I bring up that Eugene Debs quote, which is from that tome. And the fact that consistently getting that kind of ongoing engagement is so difficult. The fact that the greatest orators and organizers in American history have not been able to do it for consistent long periods. The fact that it gets away from them, even if they're able to do it for a minute, the fact that it doesn't sustain. It seems to me to say something about whether or not people really want that in their lives. Again, one of the distinctions I'm trying to draw is you and I clearly do. But a lot of people, they just want things to run well. And I don't mean that as a knock on them. It's just it seems true in basically every country. And so it makes me wonder whether or not this is more of a force of political nature than we sometimes want to admit.
Before I get to that, because that's an important probe there, we're not talking about people to be engaged on 10 issues, but people have different interests. If you get 1% of people on healthcare, okay, they don't particularly care about public transit or tax policy, but some people do care about public transit. So there's enough for everybody. So you don't have to overburden people that way. The second is, I would say half the population is so mired in just getting through the day, just trying to deal with illness and accidents and penury and daycare and dealing with each day's tribulations, that they probably don't have time for civic engagement, although they certainly should have time to make a call or two or to vote. But that still leaves half the people. And then the other thing is, and this is something which is, shall we say, beyond our common pay grade, Ezra, there is something about politics that when people think about it, it strains them. It strains their brain, literally. To them, it means controversy.
Yeah.
It means slander. It means exposing them at a city council meeting, telling them to shut up. It means fear of being sued. it means that they don't know as much about the politician who can sweet talk them and circumvent them. There is almost a mental strain. And to that I say, you know, it takes a lot to learn how to be a skilled bridge player. It takes a lot to be a skilled video game player, but it doesn't have the strain. And I don't think we've looked enough into that problem.
Well, so let me ask you. So I think that actually brings up something interesting, and it pulls me, now I can kind of stop being the very pessimistic devil's advocate here. One thing that I notice is, so one, exactly what you say, I wouldn't call it strain. I think there's a repulsion from politics. I think people look at it and it's a place of bad feelings. It's a place of fighting. You don't want to talk to your family about it. It's, people don't like conflict. Most of us are conflict avoidant, and politics, particularly in the kinds of spaces we're talking about, is a place of constant conflict. But the other piece of it that I think is a little bit embedded in what you're talking about, something I've certainly noticed, and I think of as actually the more central difficulty, is people seem to attach much more to other people than to abstract policy or even non-abstract policy, very concrete, tangible policy. I mean, you know, we my work for a long time has been trying to move the press from reporting so much on political personality and towards reporting more on policy. And I do find people are interested. But I also find that if I could get people to take 20% of the energy that goes into speculating about political personalities and who will run for president and who will win this election and just hold that energy on healthcare. If I could have gotten, you know, the energy that attached to the 08 and 12 and 16 elections among liberals and just held it on the Affordable Care Act, well, that would have been a better law. It would have been better in its design and it would have been better implemented. But the, you know, it kind of melted away when a lot of that organization melted away. And I'm not saying Obama handled it perfectly, but when it stopped being inspiring Barack Obama, you know, and his persona, and it became like the nitty gritty of hammering out like this often depressing answer, which could nevertheless help a lot of people. That piece of it seems to me to be a problem. It's not that the numbers of people you're talking about don't get involved. It's they get involved for very short episodic periods of time. They get involved attached to individual personalities, a Bernie Sanders, a Donald Trump, a Barack Obama, an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And it's very hard then to transition their involvement to long-term policy or movement building.
Well, that's true. I mean, they don't like to, say, engage in politics, but they love to watch conflict. They watch Judge Judy. They watch Trump swearing, cussing, and putting people down. It's theater. They like to watch it, but not necessarily engage in it. So that's why you have to seize the moment. You have to seize the time. If a certain issue flares in the press, you don't say, hey, you know, this is going to take a long time. Let's roll up our sleeves. You try to seize the moments, particularly in today's media climate. And so when healthcare was at its moment and Obama dropped the public option before he even had to, that's where the maximum pressure point should have come in. But, you know, we don't have a Fox network the way the other side has. It's very hard to get attention on public radio. It's very hard to get people who really know their stuff, like the doctors Himmelstein and Wallander from Harvard Medical School on healthcare. They don't get on. If I didn't get on the mass media in the 1960s, we wouldn't have had the motor vehicle and highway safety laws. I keep telling the Washington Post and New York Times, why are they so ashamed of their golden age in the 1960s when they put environmental people on and worker rights people on, civil rights people on, and consumer rights? Why? And things happened and legislation occurred and the government made the country better and people had more opportunity in health and safety. And why don't they put these people on now? Why are they just writing features for Pulitzer Prizes instead of following a story of a citizen group trying to get something through Congress? And I can never get a real answer to that. All they say is, well, you know, it's a different age. It's an internet age. It's a short attention span age. And nobody's reading print newspapers. And we're going to go out of business if we don't change our mode. And we have to have more entertainment and style and arts and food and other sections in the New York Times. But they're avoiding the issue. The basic issue is, are they serious enough to put serious people on the front media stage so these people can mobilize and get enough people to focus on the decision makers.
Well, let me try to offer a media perspective on this, just trying to think about it, because when I hear you say that, here's what I wonder. That 50s, 60s golden age you're talking about, I'm not certain that I think, you know, when I look back at it, and you would know better, of course, but that when I look back at it, there was in total more serious news or even serious coverage of social movement. But what I do think was true was that if you got on that front page, it had a lot more potency. If, you know, you got the New Republic and the New York Times to write about highway safety in the way that you did, it was more likely you could, you know, get the attention of some members of Congress. And if you got that attention, it was also more likely they could pass a bill. Whereas now what would happen is that, you know, like the public option is a great example. I actually don't agree with you that it could have been that it was not dropped at the last minute. I covered that and I have a different view. But putting aside who's right about that, that got an enormous amount of attention. It was a very serious issue. But what happened is it has got the attention. As serious people got it, and I think of people like Jacob Hacker here, who knows an enormous amount about healthcare, is I believe still Yale, and helped inject that into the public debate. Then it became a corresponding issue on the other side. It had Fox News. It had Rush Limbaugh. These things that weren't there in the 50s and 60s and weren't there to say, oh, that would be socialism. That would be a death panel. That would be. And so I think it's not just that you have a, you know, more competitive, and in some cases, I do agree, more sensationalized media environment. I think it's also that, you know, you have much less of a conveyor from the media to the Congress to legislation. Every piece of that is more broken than it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s, such that you could get a great story about this, and it still wouldn't go anywhere, in my view.
Well, my recollection, by the way, parenthetically, is that Obama dropped the public option before he started negotiating what is known as Obamacare.
No. I mean, there were different versions of a public option, but the public option was killed by Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson. I mean, I covered that, and they basically said at the end, like, not only will we not vote for that, Lieberman then said there was an effort to create a compromise where you could buy into Medicare at 55, and Lieberman said he would kill the entire bill if that compromise was held.
No, you're right
in
there,
the bill.
But Obama never picked it up from the beginning and really pushed it. You're right on who destroyed it in the Senate. But what you said, Ezra, is accurate but incomplete. Let me give you a fuller picture of the difference between the 60s, 70s, and now. Phil Donahue had 10 million viewers. He put on the breakthrough people in civil rights, labor, women's rights, LGBT rights, environmental people, consumer advocates. He got them before 10 million people more than once. The press picked up. Other TV picked up. They're all gone now. All the radio program people, the talk show hosts, including Larry King, overnight, huge audience. We used to get on. We would evaluate the presidential candidates. We would highlight consumer legislation. We would expose things. All gone now. The Jackson show in L.A., the Williams show in Boston, radio. It's now junk. In fact, afternoon TV, network TV is so bad that if you talk with anybody who ever thinks about public issues, they never watch it. They don't even know how bad it is. Once in a while, I turn on network TV on Saturday afternoon to see how my property is being used, how the public airways, which we all own as a people, as a commons, which is given free 24/7 to the radio and TV stations. And it's disgraceful. The liberal left has completely abandoned the radio and TV scene to the corporatists, the entertainers, the schlockers, the infomercial people, the rerun endless movie people. And they've just abandoned it. There are 600 cable channels. There isn't one devoted to labor. There isn't one devoted to students. There isn't one devoted to consumer issues. There isn't one devoted to environmental issues. 600 cable channels. The left has just given up on it. So the link between citizen groups, the whole citizen community, where all this stuff starts, all over the country, the link between that and what's left of the media is very tenuous. So there are really a lot of differences. I don't want to idealize the 60s, 70s. We had a problem with advertisers, censors, people afraid of GM. They would never mention a car by make and model if it was being recalled until we broke that taboo. But by comparison, it's night and day.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been podcast futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it, didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/gray area. That's greenlight.com/gray area to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/gray area.
So let me ask you about something tactical in that era. I've always been very curious about the period of time after you got the highway bill passed, the auto safety bill passed, and building Nader's Raiders. And I've always been very curious, when you got these young people in and said, hey, investigate the FTC or whoever it might be, what instructions did you give them? What was the playbook you gave Nader's Raiders to go and ferret out what was happening at a government agency or go and understand what was happening at a government agency?
I give them a lot of autonomy. First of all, we had a huge amount of resumes to pick from. So first of all, we got really motivated, knowledgeable, hardworking youngsters coming in. Second, I had them read upside down whatever is written on the Department of Agriculture or the Federal Trade Commission or the Food and Drug Administration. Third, I had them go and talk with the outside experts on it so that they could always call them when they needed. And fourth, I introduced them to the heads of the agencies. You know, I would go down with them and say, you know, these young people, they are fully capable of doing an evaluation of your performance and putting it together in a report. And when we got back to the office, I would tell them, if you had any trouble, I've got your back. And at that time, you know, I could call Martin Mintz of the Post, or I could call Pat Sloyan of UPI, and we'd get some exposure if some agency was trying to close them out. And I gave them a lot of autonomy. Then they knew that they were going to be the authors of the report. It wasn't going to be my name on the book with a footnote or an acknowledgement to Joe or Jane Schmo that they did a lot of work and thank you very much. We made them authors at a very young age, and they knew they'd have a huge step up when at age 23, 24, 25, they're authors of a book which had a substantial circulation and got a lot of media coverage.
And so when you looked for these people, what did you look for?
I looked for a thirst for justice, a passion for justice. That is, they had to show some fire in the belly, not just some cognitive capabilities. That's one. The second is, were they just out to burnish their resume? At that time, it was a big deal to be a Nader's Raider. Or were they seriously interested in effecting change? Third, did they hog credit because they had to work with a group? Or did they know how to share credit? Did they have personal skills? And fourth, and most important, where they're going to stay to completion. Because, you know, September comes, they're back at school or they're out. And, you know, we'd be left with one or two members of the task force. And it might not get done on time. So they have to stay with it, like Jim Fallows stayed with it and put the book out on the Savannah River polluters while he was at Harvard undergrad. Or a task force from Miss Porter's school, they stuck with it until they put out the report on the nursing home abuses in America, and they testified for the House and Senate at age 18 and got a lot of mass media. Try that today.
And how did you pick up on nursing home abuses as a topic you would want to focus on? How did you get from big picture, national, you know, millions of people are dying in car accidents on the road who maybe don't need to Savannah River pollution or nursing homes?
Well, after I, you know, got the auto and highway safety bill through with help, I didn't want to be a lone ranger and I didn't want to be a single issue person. And people didn't let me be a single issue person. They'd flood me with envelopes, sometimes without return addresses, with incriminating materials about a local pollution issue, a company town in North Carolina, a paper mill corporation in Maine, polluting the rivers. And then third, I read a lot. I mean, I was, you know, inherently a broad gauge muckraker from when I was 13 years old.
What muck were you raking at 13?
I was muckraking the books on the power structure. I read Ida Tarbell on Standard Oil. And I read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Trembling with excitement while I was listening to the Yankees radio station WINS. I was dual tasking.
Do you think you were an unusual kid?
Not that unusual. I didn't have any contacts. I didn't have money when I started out.
I don't mean like that. I mean in your personal proclivities. That you're reading, you know, muckraking books at 13.
I think unusual parents and unusual elder siblings. I was the fourth of four children. I had a great big brother, and he raised us the way my mother and father raised us. And I have incredible memories of very powerful imprints. I mean, one day he brought home the Encyclopedia Americana. That was a big deal in those days, all those red-bound volumes, and we were all awed. And he said, "Come here, Ralph." And he pulled out the H, and he went to Hawaii. And he said, "Read this." And it was, you know, a page or two. And so I read it. He was about 19, 20. I was 8 years younger, and I read it, and he said, "What'd you think?" I said, "Well, that's interesting that the Hawaiians asked the Marines to come and overthrow their queen." He said, "Do you really believe that?" He said, "Let me give you a little lesson. Don't believe everything you read. The queen was not overthrown by her supporters, by her subordinates, by the people. This was a bunch of plantation owners, sugar, pineapple, who wanted to get rid of the queen and wanted the U.S. Marines there to protect their profits." So how do you forget a lesson like that, Ezra? You see what I mean? So in that way, I was lucky.
If you were 13 today, you would have access to so much more information. I mean, anything you could possibly want in the world. It would not be a big deal to get the Encyclopedia Britannica. It'd be unbelievably limiting and absurd. Do you think you'd be better or worse informed as a 13-year-old today?
The curse of abundance. The fact that they can get any information at their fingertips means they don't ingest information and retain it in their memory and therefore build on it. It's what I call the curse of abundance. When that set of Americana Encyclopedia came, that was scarcity. That was a rarity. That, you know, tripled the number of informed pages in our household. Not that we didn't have many books, but it was that sense that you read them. I mean, I grew up near the first law school in America in Litchfield, Connecticut, before Harvard and Yale Law School got started, and they recreated it, and it's a tourist attraction now. And I went there a few years ago. It was called Tappan Reeve Law School Restored, and they had two large bookcases, And they were all the law books in America, virtually, were on those two large books. Well, now, if you're a law student, you're going to feel that's a pretty precious opportunity to read those books. You tend to retain it. You digest it. Now, you give a youngster a book, it's almost like you're insulting them. Do I have to carry this? One person told me, 14-year-old recently. Do I have to carry this? Is it online? I said, yeah, you do have to carry it.
I think about this a lot in the sense of, I don't know how to think about the kind of information abundance we have now and whether it will long-term make us a better, worse country. I want to believe it will make us better. And certainly I am someone, you know, Tyler Cowen would call an infovore. I'm someone who, you know, I loved when I found blogs and online reading and journalism. And, you know, like I used to spend most of my nights in bookstores. I mean, I just like being around books and words. I find it calming. And on the other hand, I can feel the way in which there's so much now that I find it even harder to focus on any one thing. And I've kind of pulled back and read less online and more books. And I don't know if that's me just becoming older and crankier or there's really something there. I was thinking about something you said earlier in our conversation about how people are slaves to contracts. And I think that something that you're saying there is that complexity can defeat us. An easy way to defeat people is to make things too complex to find out what's the truth or what you're even really telling them. And I worry that spaces of unbelievable information abundance are also spaces where it's very easy to get people to turn off because it's so overwhelming. It's so impossible to know everything that why try to really know any of it?
I think corporate political strategies rely on complexity as a strategy because complexity shrinks the audience that could possibly confront them.
This is a big Elizabeth Warren argument.
And also, that's what jargon is all about. That's what lawyers' jargon is all about. It's like proprietary tools to further the monopoly of the legal profession. The same with the medical profession. So this is a long-standing, far before the internet, technique of power structures. Is complexity, enormous detail, look at the tax code, only a few people can understand it. And I once had lunch with the head of the IRS in the Carter administration, Ezra. That was an interesting thing. And I said, you know, I've been told by people the insurance part of the tax code is so complex that fewer people understand it than understand Einstein's theory of relativity. What do you think? He said, I think that's right. I said, well, that is why you can't enforce it. He said, yeah, we can't even find the actuaries for expert witnesses because there's so few of them that grasp it, and they're hired by the insurance companies.
What do you think of Elizabeth Warren?
I think she gets it on corporate power, which is very rare for liberal and progressive candidates. She gets it on Wall Street. She gets fine print contracts, which she calls mice print contracts full of traps, giving up our rights, even the right to go to court. Contract law is now cannibalizing tort law, the law of wrongful injury. It's getting people to sign waivers of liability, waivers of trial by jury. What no government can force you to give up. These contracts get you to give up. And so I think she gets that. She's fairly weak on military and foreign policy, a little bit because she's afraid of it, and a little bit because she's like Bernie Sanders. She wants to concentrate on corporate power in this country and not diverge into foreign and military issues. And in a way, she's right. And I think that's why Bernie got so far, by the way, in 2016. Bread and butter issues, corporate power, living wage, full Medicare for all, free college tuition, on and on. And he wasn't distracted by getting embroiled in the Israeli-Palestinian issue, for example.
From your perspective, is there a meaningful difference between Sanders and Warren?
Yes, I think there is. The difference coming into 2020 is that he's more willing to take controversial positions on empire and Middle East politics. And she is much more willing to get into the details of Wall Street financial shenanigans and the control of people's money. So that's why I think they would make a good team. Flip the coin, one goes for president, the other goes for vice president.
Do you think that their prominence in the Democratic Party, the fact that, you know, there are easily two of the three or four or five front runners in 2020, do you think that means the Democratic Party, do you believe the Democratic Party has substantially shifted, has changed since 2000 or 2004, even 2008?
It hasn't shifted in terms of its core control by the corporate Democrats, who still control the Democratic National Committee, who still control the apparatus at the state level. It's still under that control. And I think Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders better be pretty aware of that in the primary season. All kinds of dirty tricks can be played once they decide they want Joe Biden or someone that they've anointed. It is more disparate and more free-thinking in terms of what people with the Democratic Party label on them are talking about. They're now talking about corporate crime, corporate welfare. They're talking about globalization, corporate globalization. In that sense, it's a healthy sign. But they're still on the outskirts. They're still on the edges of the party's power structure, which is still rooted heavily in New York City and in Wall Street.
When you say that there are dirty tricks that can be played, that it's still under corporate power, does the ability of people like Warren and Sanders and now Ocasio-Cortez to rise to power rapidly, does it make you think anything different about how the institutional structure of the party works? I mean, it seems to me that there's some tension between particularly the openness, actually in some ways of both parties. You can see Donald Trump is an example of this from an ideological side I like less. That the control of these parties seems to be very weakened to me. Whether or not it was there before, it does not seem to me that the people who thought they had a handle on it do now. Do you think that's wrong?
No, they are losing control, but they still have control. And remember, we still have a winner-take-all situation. We don't have rank voting. We have an ability, whoever's in charge of the election machinery, say the primary in Nevada, and it's really close between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and they count the votes with the pro-union Hillary Clinton counters in a casino, that they can flip it if it's a margin of 2 or 3 points. And that's pretty damaging.
Is your view that that happened?
I would say it's presumptively that is what happened. And I think a lot of that kind of shaving happened in Iowa. And they couldn't do it in New Hampshire. And Bernie won it in a landslide.
That's a pretty serious allegation, particularly given that Sanders won more caucus states than he won primary states. And in states where you have this kind of counting and these more informal mechanisms, he in general did better.
Well, you see, that's another problem. That's another problem of equitable democracy. It's like the Electoral College. You know, people run to get voters, and they get the voters, and the presidential vote comes down on one side, and then they lose the office to someone who got fewer voters because of the Electoral College. Well, there are a lot of little Electoral College-type shenanigans in primary state laws, in ballot access laws, in how votes are counted, and when votes are counted, and which votes are counted, and when they come in from overseas. And that's why all the problem with vote counting should be viewed from the example of Canada. Canada still has a paper ballot, and they know who wins and who doesn't by 11 o'clock at night. They're a pretty big country. We have a corrupt voting machine procurement system where the software is proprietarily owned by a corporation, which at one time was headed by a guy who favored George W. Bush, can you imagine? So it's a nightmare of our own making. So many of our problems in our country are nightmares of our own making.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Do you think we're a better country than we were 50 years ago?
In some ways, certainly. In terms of entryways, civil rights, civil liberties for people is better. But certainly it's better environmentally, although there are new hazards that keep coming over the horizon. People are eating, if they want to, more nutritious food. They have more nutritious choices, not just tip-top bread in the supermarkets anymore. Access to justice is being restricted. The criminal injustice system is worse, can you believe, than in the 60s and 70s. Look at the mass incarceration rates. Look at going from less than a million to several million people in jail in 30 years. So it's mixed. And we shouldn't start selecting the bad parts and then becoming pessimistic, or just selecting the good parts and becoming Pollyannish, like a Harvard professor has in recent writings.
What do you think of Howard Schultz running as an independent?
I think if he sticks to it, because he's a multi-billionaire, he will get regular media. He will be able to get on 50 state ballots. Whether he can stay on is another subject. He will get polls regularly, which means he'll get a chance to start popping up 5, 10, 15% in the polls the way Perot did. However, he's up against a two-party duopoly. Perot got 19 million votes in 1992 and not a single electoral college vote, not one. Shows you the final gateway protection for the two-party duopoly. He can turn it into a three-way race. He will provoke the political bigotry of being called a spoiler by the Democrats. The polls may show he is pulling from liberal Republicans as well as Democrats. So he turns it into a three-way race. And then someone who's a multi-billionaire says, three-way race? What about a four-way race? And Mark Cuban gets in. And then it's off to the races. I must say I predicted this. Years ago, people would say to me, Ralph, is there ever going to be a viable third party? And I said, well, I'd like to see one from grassroots America, but it's more likely that it'll be initiated by a multi-billionaire. And that's what we're going to see from now on, by the way, Ezra, not just 2020.
So I'm going to ask you, I will say this up front, zero questions about 2000 or 2004, just because I think I have nothing new to add to that conversation. But what I want to ask you about here is a slightly more philosophical question. When do you believe people should run for, speaking here of the presidency, but really in anything, inside the party versus try to mount an independent bid? Because I think with Trump and Sanders, there's some clear evidence that the parties can change quite a bit if you're running inside of them. And I think one question people have about Schultz is, why is he running outside? What is he bringing to that needs to happen through the dynamics of an independent bid? What do you think are the conditions under which somebody should run inside the parties, and what are the conditions under which they should run outside?
Well, if they look at history and they don't have a strong foothold inside one of the two major parties, they would say, small parties have started most of the justice movements in America inside the electoral arena. The Liberty Party in 1840, anti-slavery, the women's rights to vote party, the populist progressive party, labor party, and then 20th century, almost everything that the two parties or one of them picked up as a major issue and implemented came from a third party. And more recently, the Socialist Party of Norman Thomas, it was Social Security, unemployment, compensation, on and on, Medicare. So if you have the historical reference as a motivator, you would have no trouble starting a third party. The only problem is in the last 30 years, that has changed. That has changed because the two parties have become much more rigid and bigoted against challenges from their flank, and the press doesn't cover the third party.
Challenges from their flank, you mean challenges from a third party?
Yeah, in part because of the presidential debate racket, which is a private company run by two parties, and they get the cooperation of the network, so they have exclusive relay of the candidates, and they block access. They have this ridiculous 15% average polling by five commercial polling companies owned by mass media companies before a third-party candidate can get on a national debate. It's absurd. But it may be absurd, but listen, in 2000, I spoke to the largest mass audiences of any presidential candidate that year, including Al Gore and George W. Bush. But I only reached 2% of the people I could have reached had I been on just one presidential debate. So it's the extinction impact of third-party presidential candidates by just being kept off the national debates. And because the media knows that, they know they can't win. They cover them less and less. And 95% of the coverage of my campaigns, where I had agendas that were supported by majority polls, like health care and living wage, etc., I wasn't pushing UFOs. I had majoritarian agendas that were off the table on the part of the two major parties, the Republican and Democrat. 95% of the coverage was, how's it feel to be a spoiler? Do you think you're a spoiler? Why are you being a spoiler? And I would say, what are you talking about? I'm challenging a spoiled, rotten political system, and you're accusing me of being a spoiler?
So one of the things, without to get too much into the spoiler debate, one of the things that seems to me to be part of the reason that debate has gotten more intense, as you put it, is that American politics has gotten closer. I had Frances Lee, who's a great political scientist, on the show a couple weeks ago, and something she was talking about is that for most of American history, you had a dominant party. For a long time, it was Republicans, and then it was in the post-Depression and New Deal period, it was the Democrats. And now everything's very knife's edge, and the parties are very polarized. So the idea that somebody could come in from the outside and tip it, when it's so close, it's very easy to tip. And then conversely, the parties are also in a strange way opening up. Again, Donald Trump, I think, is an example of this. Bernie Sanders, to some degree, an example from the other side. And so there's a sense that more can be done inside the parties and that there's more danger running outside of them because you'll inevitably probably draw from whichever side you're closer to. And that seems to be the kind of cocktail that makes this worse. I'm a fan of things like ranked choice voting and proportional representation and other things that would make that would open up the system a little bit. But in the absence of them, that seems to me to be why this gets so much hotter.
Well, let me disagree with a little bit of what you said, because the polarization of the two major parties is caused by the two major parties, because they've divided the country up. And the Democrats, for example, wrote off half the country. They don't, in the presidential campaigns, they don't campaign in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Texas. And you know what happens when that occurs? It shrivels the party all the way down to the elected dog catcher, right down to the municipal level. Ben Barnes, the boy wonder of Texas Democratic politics years ago, told me that when the Democrats wrote off Texas, they destroyed the Democratic Party at the congressional level and at the mayorly level, the governor level, and at the town council level. So they created the red state, blue state polarization. Number two, they decided to campaign on divisive issues like reproductive rights or school prayer or things of that intensity. And they ignored at least 25 areas of convergence and change in this country supported by liberals and conservatives down at the grassroots of America. Look at the polls for a higher minimum wage. Look at the polls for Medicare for All, without even one major party promoting it.
Oh, but that's not true that neither party promotes a higher minimum wage. That's on the Democratic agenda in every election I've ever covered.
Just recently, for example, the Democratic Party under Obama promised $9.50 in 2008 to occur by 2011. He never touched it. He never talked about it. I know because I've trying to get everybody from the AFL-CIO to Congressman George Miller to get on with minimum wage, to have hearings on minimum wage, to push the Republicans up against the wall when they controlled the Congress on minimum wage. For Hillary Clinton came in last of a prominent Democrat to sponsor a modest minimum wage of $10.10. If the Democrats made living wage a national issue again and again, front burner, they would not have lost the presidential campaigns. There were 30 million workers at any given time making less in inflation-adjusted wages than they made in 1968. And a lot of those workers didn't see any need to vote because it didn't mean anything to them. Instead, they could have said, workers, you've earned it. You deserve it. Go vote for a raise. Go vote for a raise.
So I'll take, they didn't do it. So I will. I'll take the other side of this for a minute. I agree in part on this, I think. I certainly agree that you can have positions that do more for working class people than the Democrats have had and certainly than the Republicans have had. But a place where I really diverge on this theory of politics, and I find it actually quite frustrating, is that the two parties aren't close on this stuff. You know, you could say, I don't remember the exact history of when the Obama administration prioritized or pushed minimum wage pushes and when they didn't. I know they pushed quite a number of them, but they had a gigantic raft of proposals from expansions of the child tax credits and the extensions of TANF to Obamacare itself, which was a massive transfer of hundreds of billions and over decades, trillions of dollars from richer Americans down to people who actually needed it in their health insurance. I don't think it is a case that the public is so confused over which party wants to move in a direction where you would be redistributing money to the middle class or to the working class. I look at polls on this all the time, and people know what's going on. Now, you could say the Democrats could go further, and fair enough, and some of them, like Bernie Sanders, do. But there is this consistent view of the electorate that the electorate actually holds all of whoever is speaking my opinions. And if only Democrats would say it, like I saw a poll, and then it would all change. I mean, look, Medicare for All is a good example of this. I'm a supporter of Medicare for All. But Kaiser just did a poll, and it shows that if you poll Medicare for All, you get majority support. Not huge, but you get it. Then if you say it'll raise taxes, you don't get majority support. And if you say it'll mean you don't have private health insurance, you get huge majority disapproval. And so oftentimes people say, oh, you know, actually everybody agrees with me. But then if you just tweak the poll a bit or use any of the counterarguments that will emerge, it changes. I think that the American public is harder to convince in that and knows what they think a little bit more deeply than that vision of politics often gives them credit for.
The problem is there are no mass movements in these areas. The labor movement is not a mass movement anymore. And the Democrats, you know, they've written off half the country and they're not really a mass movement in the way they used to be on some issues under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's all about the intensity, visibility, and repetition of redirections in our country. It's not enough to have a throwaway phrase on minimum wage, but the main issues you have to deal with are military budget, peace, you know, through strength. Are you for a bigger military budget? Well, the reason why the Democrats get derailed on public works and infrastructure investment, which really has a huge support, right, back home, the Chamber of Commerce, the workers, the small business, who doesn't want the roads repaired? Who doesn't want a new drinking water sewage system? Who doesn't want the library restored or community health clinics? The reason why they get derailed on that, which is a great vote getter, by the way, because it's jobs that pay well that can't be exported abroad, is they're all hung up on not challenging the military budget. It's become a no-no since Senator Proxmire used to challenge it in public hearings. The Democrats and Republicans, they just whiffed through Congress with hardly any scrutiny.
You mean to get the money from the military budget to do these other things?
Yes. The military budget now, with no known major enemy, unless we want to create them around the world, is 55% of the operating budget of the federal government. 55%.
You're talking about non-mandatory spending.
We're talking about all the departmental and agency budgets.
Yeah, I often say, and I'm not the first one to come up with this, that the federal government is an insurance company with a standing army. And that if you're getting money, you have to get it from one of those two places. You're either getting it from the big insurance programs, which together are bigger than the military budget, or you're getting it from the military budget. Or if you're not doing that, you're cutting much smaller things.
But Ezra, they're not supposed to compete with one another.
No, I agree with that.
Operating budgets are supposed to compete with one another.
Well, one I think difference I have on actually the political philosophy you're putting out here, and maybe even puts me a bit to the left on of you, is some of these public infrastructure and you know, getting water cleaned up and that set of priorities. I would not at all add that to a confrontation with the military. If you don't, like, it's not clear to me that you need to pay for that in real time. Maybe you want to, and then you can increase taxes on rich people or whatever it might be. But also, I'm not sure you do. I'm having a conversation on the podcast in a couple of weeks. It's going to be all about this. But the question of how much real-time financing you need is an open one. And it's one where I think that Democrats have been, possibly to their detriment, to the detriment of a bunch of their issues, a lot more responsible than the right. But maybe you don't need to be quite that.
You're quite right there. But let's flesh out what you're saying. Mm-hmm. If you don't block tax cuts for the rich that create huge bit deficits, then it's hard to raise capital for public works because they say, oh, you're adding to the deficit. You see? So one is connected to the other, even though investment in public works, which creates a deficit, let's say, is an investment. You get a return on capital. But a huge tax cut for multinationals and the super rich, you're not getting any return on capital. They are not job creators, as the subsequent studies to the tax cut by Trump have shown relentlessly. And then the other thing, which people don't talk about, is it isn't just the military budget sucking money out of, say, a public works budget. They're sucking engineering talent. They're sucking scientific talent. They're doing what a professor of industrial engineering at Columbia pointed out. They are taking rare technological and scientific research away from the civilian economy. So when New York City put out for bid new subway cars a number of years ago, they didn't get a single bid from a U.S. company. Never mind the U.S. company lost a bid. They didn't even submit a bid. We've lost our civilian technology here because we're so proficient in military technology and all that's associated with it. So there's a lot of aspects here to being a militarized society or a civilized society waging peace.
If you could pass any bill, if you had one shot, right? And recognizing bills can be common. I don't mean like, well, I'd put it all in one bill, but you know, any one policy. What do you think is the one policy that would make the most difference?
I don't think there is one policy that would make the most difference.
But you only got one.
Here's my one policy, since you've provoked me. It would be to shift power from the few to the many in a 10-point program, facilitating labor unions, consumer cooperatives, getting people their own audience network on radio and TV, a few hours a day reverting the public airways to organized media cooperatives, empowering small taxpayers to have standing to sue, to challenge privileged tax escapes by the super rich and the corporations. It's all shift of power. I would have an empowerment agenda in Congress.
So, and then the flip side of this, there's a question of what the government should do and maybe what the private sector should undo. Something you've written about in some of your books is the belief that too much of American life has been commercialized. What are some spaces where you would carve out more space from commercialization?
Well, I think a survival for any democratic society is commercial-free zones. So elections should not be for sale. Government should not be for sale. Childhood should not be for sale. The commercial exploitation of childhood is such that I got a standing ovation once denouncing the electronic child molesters of our children from a extreme evangelical audience. So childhood should not be for sale. There are certain aspects of our environment should not be for sale. For example, we should not corporatize public parks, national forests, etc. I think that the genetic area should not be for sale. So there are certain areas that should be public education, should not be commercialized, very heavily commercialized now. I believe in public libraries, not libraries part of buildings that have supermarkets and movie houses. Those are the areas that should be commercially free zones. Now, what's happened in the last 50 years is that commercialism has invaded these zones tremendously. When I was growing up, it was unheard of for corporations to direct market to kids, bypassing parental authority and supervision, other than maybe bubble gum. Now it's open season. It's a multi-hundred-billion-dollar business. They get kids age 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. They shape their diets. They shape their military toys. They shape cosmetics for girls at age 5. On and on. And then they get them to be participants in violent programming and interactive violent TV. This would be unheard of years ago. They'd be run out of town. So we have commercialized our society in defiance of the wisdom of all organized religions going back over 2,000 years. Every one of them warned their believers against giving too much power to the merchant class. Why? Because the merchant class is a monoculture. It is maniacally focused on profiteering, on enrichment at the expense of all other values. They will trample them, co-opt them, destroy them, degrade them, exploit them. And so it goes back many, many, many hundreds of years. And that's why I say the global corporations all about commercializing everything. They're looking at that $500-600 billion public school budget as an investment opportunity. I mean, there isn't anything they don't want to commercialize. Nothing, not even our genetic inheritance, not even our redwood trees that are 1,800 years old. They'd cut them down in a minute.
So I hate then to end the podcast on a commercial note, but the question we always finish on is, what are three books you've read that have influenced you that you would recommend to others? And they can also, of course, get them from the library.
Well, I think very much of a book that showed how executive pay compensation distorts the whole priorities of these large corporations by leading to trillions of dollars of wasteful stock buybacks to increase the metrics for executive compensation. So I would recommend The CEO Pay Machine by Steve Clifford, who was actually on a number of these corporate compensation committees. I think Michael Lewis has opened up a literary appeal of talking about government public services. I think Alan Hirsch's very clear book called Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future is a very educational, nonpartisan paperback that just came out. I think Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, he's the original author of Black Swan, but he wrote a book called Skin in the Game, where he basically said that people in power will much more likely abuse power if they don't have skin in the game, like politicians and corporate executives and corporate immunities and impunities. I like the more recent book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, on the impact of the Facebooks and the Googles. And personally, I like my brand new fable called How the Rats Reformed the Congress, because I want to try to make people laugh enough to be serious, laugh themselves seriously into organizing Congress watchdog groups in every congressional district, the 1% of the Congress reflecting public opinion, the 1% of the people reflecting public opinion, organized as a civic hobby, a civic Congress watchdog hobby, to summon the senators and representatives to their periodic town meetings and send them back with their instructions on behalf of the people. And the Rats Reform the Congress.org website gives serious instruction on how to start a Congress Watch local and build it into a decisive impact on issues as supported by left and right, conservatives and liberals, down where America lives, works, and raises their families. RightsReformCongress.org.
Ralph Nader, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ezra Klein, for treating subjects in America seriously for a change.
Thank you, Mr. Nader, for being here. Thank you to Topher Ruth at UC Berkeley, to Jeff Geld, Vox Media, Julian Weinberger, my producer. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.